is this. Case. Dijon asked Phaon, "Where are you going?" Phaon said, "Around on a pilgrimage." Dijon said, "What is the purpose of pilgrimage?" Phaon said, "I don't know." Dijon said, "Not knowing is nearest." Verse. Now having studied it to the full, it's just like before. Having shed entirely the finest thread, he reaches not knowing. Let it be short, let it be long. Stop cutting and patching. Going along with the high, along with the low, it levels itself. The abundance or scarcity of the house is used according to the occasion. Roaming serenely in the land, he goes wherever his feet take him. The purpose of 10 years pilgrimage. Clearly, he turned his back on one pair of eyebrows. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen today on this midsummer day. Very hot out there. It's wonderful that people have come together to practice like this morning. So this koan is quite, I think, an important koan, maybe one of the most important of all the koans. I'm going to just read it aloud again. Dijon asked Phaon, "Where are you going?" Phaon said, "Around on pilgrimage." Dijon said, "What is the purpose of pilgrimage?" Phaon said, "I don't know." Dijon said, "Not knowing is nearest." People go on pilgrimages, usually by leaving their home, leaving the place they live, and going someplace quite exotic. So, in Spain, there are a number of pilgrimage routes, and tens of thousands of people have become very popular, and tens of thousands of people go on these pilgrimages. In Tibet, also, it's quite common for people to go on pilgrimages, often to Mount Kailash. And they circumambulate the mountain. They walk all the way around it. This is a devotional practice, kind of a meditation. In Japan as well, there are some very famous pilgrimage sites. And actually, there are orders of monks, they're not Zen monks, but they're Buddhist monks, whose practice is actually just walking to these pilgrimage sites or walking into the mountains and so on. And of course, in China, there has a long tradition of pilgrimage. People have gone to one of the five sacred mountains of China, and there are five Buddhist mountains, and there are a number of mountains that are dedicated to Lao Tzu's path, Lao Tzu's teaching. And sometimes the Buddhist temple and the Taoist temple are on the same mountain. They're just in slightly different locations. And if you ever have a chance to go to Emeshan, which I've never been to, but I've seen many photos, it's quite majestically perched on a cliff, and you can walk up many thousands of steps, very steep steps, up the side of this extraordinary mountain and go to the top. So, a pilgrimage is really important. It's a frame of mind, and it really is based on the idea that what is really sacred or what is really special is quite far from where we are. And so people go on pilgrimage, leaving home, and usually it's in an exotic place. And basically, this is like home leaving, going to a special place like Tibet or Nepal. And everything around you is new and fresh. And the sacred is imagined as being on this big mountain somewhere. And you have to make the pilgrimage up the mountain. So this is what the koan's about. One teacher asked the other, he said, "What are you doing here? What are you doing here?" And Fayon said, I'm going on a pilgrimage. I'm making the rounds on a pilgrimage." And Dijon said, "What's the purpose of a pilgrimage?" Now, these are two really deeply accomplished Zen masters, really deeply accomplished. So if this person were not a Zen teacher, were not a teacher of Chan, you know, basically he would say, pilgrimage represents the unattainable, the transcendent, you know. He would speak pretty much as I've just been speaking a little bit. Fayon is really deeply awake. And so when Dijong said, what's the purpose of a pilgrimage? Fayon says, I don't know. And Dijong says, that's a good answer. Not knowing is the best. Not knowing is nearest. You get closest by not knowing. So this is such a wonderful koan. I have been doing some research lately on environmental conflict, conflict over global warming, evolution, and these sorts of disputes. And I'm fascinated. You know, something like half of all Americans don't believe global warming is real. That's actually true. And I myself believe global warming is quite real. And I think there's a huge amount of evidence. But about half of our fellow Americans don't believe that. And, you know, actually more than half of Americans don't believe in evolution. Now, you know, the last thing I want to do is make fun of these people. And I'm not going to do that. I think it's fascinating that so many of these people don't believe these things. You know, I just think that's really interesting. This is why I'm studying up on it. A number of years ago, I served on a committee with a microbiologist. And I'm not going to give you too many details about him, but he's a distinguished microbiologist. And I talked to him one day about education, and he said, "Well, I don't send my kids to public school." I said, "Oh, do you send them to private school?" He said, no, I homeschool them." So I thought, oh, that's interesting. And, you know, it turns out that this professor, he's a distinguished professor of microbiology, he said to me, and I don't think he was pulling my leg, he said, I believe the world was created in 6 days. It's like, huh? You know, I thought, you were the last person, you know, I didn't want to challenge him, or I just sort of nodded like, okay, man, you know, whatever, you know. And I didn't want to ridicule him because, you know, actually he's done many wonderful things at Rutgers. He has done a lot to help underprivileged students and minority students get into the sciences. And he has a good heart, I would say. You know, this has gotten me to thinking. You know, here's a guy who's gone through like a very top-notch graduate program in microbiology. And he sat across from me and he said, "I don't really believe the Earth is 13.5 billion years old. I think it's 6,000 years old." And, you know, actually, as I've been researching all of this stuff, you know, I'm surprised at how many people who are like crusaders against global warming actually are really well educated. You know, some of them went to like Oxford, Cambridge, you know, very articulate, thoughtful people, and yet they're opposed to something. It's so frustrating because, you know, we want to just say you haven't seen the facts. You know, you guys haven't seen the facts. But they've seen the facts, and they still believe what they believe. I think that's just really important. You know, for many years I used to teach a course on environmental policy. You know, believe it or not, with a friend of mine who was from the biology department, and it was a 6-credit package, and he would teach the science part, and I would do the readings on policy with him, with the students.
And they would write papers. It was really a writing course, you know. And they would write these wonderful papers. And I really loved teaching that course. It was one of the best experiences in my life. But I would meet these students, you know, who were very articulate, very thoughtful, and absolutely dead set against, global climate change as an idea. And I had this one student who was a physics major, and he wrote this paper in which he made this argument against the IPCC, the International Climate Change Commission. And he wrote this very complicated paper, and I didn't understand it. So I had to go find my friend, the biologist, and then he showed it to a physicist, and we all looked at it. And I respected this young man so much, but I just couldn't understand why he wouldn't get on board with an idea that just seems so overwhelmingly true. And, I think actually, you know, it's easy to laugh at these people, but, I think we've created a problem in our society. You know, we've had 50 years to think about the environmental crisis. When I was in high school, in fact, it might even be earlier than high school. I think I might have been in elementary school when Rachel Carson wrote her wonderful book on the environmental crisis, you know, and Silent Spring. You may not have ever read that book, but when it came out, it created a sensation. It was about really primarily the use of pesticides and how, you know, all these pesticides were being used and lots of birds, like hawks, were disappearing from the American landscape. And Carson was a biologist, a very careful, very scholarly researcher, and she showed how pesticides were making the shells of birds so thin that the little chicks couldn't come to maturity. And there was all this evidence, all these broken shells in the nests, you know. And when the book came out, it created quite a storm of controversy because, you know, the pesticide companies were very invested in this. And but, you know, this was a long, long time ago. And, you know, I was, my wife is a member of a garden club. And they are all quite upset because it turns out that bees are being killed by using these pesticides. We have almost no bees. You know, today we went walking outside through the grass. And when I was a little boy, if we had walked through that grass, which is all this clover blooming, we would have stepped on at least one bee, you know. I would have stepped on several bees, and then I would have gone into the building crying, and my mother would have to put my foot in water and baking soda and get me something like a popsicle or something to make me stop crying. So when I was a kid, a field like that would be covered with bees. Now, there's hardly a bee. You know, we didn't see a single bee. So, you know, here we are, right back where Rachel Carson was, like 50 years ago, you know, actually more than 50 years ago. So that's really an astonishing fact. It's like we haven't made any real progress all this time, you know. And so I'm really interested in why nothing is changing. You know, there's lots of facts. But nobody is changed by all these facts. And I actually think this is quite important. You know, we've put all our chips on facts. You know, all of our chips on facts as a civilization. We think facts are going to solve the problem. But when we have facts, a lot of people aren't persuaded. And even people who are persuaded don't change their behavior. So this is like a really big question. And a really important question. We have a long history of believing in what we call objectivity. And, you know, I do think objectivity is important. So, you know, if I have a surgeon who's working on me and I'm having some kind of problem with my tonsils. I don't want him to remove my kidneys, Say, well, maybe the kidneys are where it all happens. Who am I to say? You want somebody who knows anatomy, who's up on the latest science. So I understand, facts are very important. I'm not making fun of facts. I'm not saying let's forget about facts. I believe in all these facts about global warming. But I think there's something wrong with how we approach the world every day. That's where I'm headed with this. If you came early this morning, we recite the verses on the heart mind. This is another way to translate it is trust in mind. And one of the passages in the trust in mind verses, which are really key for understanding Zen, I'm going to read some of the least interesting passages in the whole thing. And when we recite them, your mind probably just glazes over and you think, well, I have no idea what this is about. Let me get through this as fast as possible. But he said, the Shinshin Mi. When no discriminating thoughts arise, the old mind ceases to exist. When thought objects vanish, the thinking subject vanishes. As when the mind vanishes, object vanishes. Things are objects because of the subject, mind. The mind, subject, is such because of things, object. It sounds a little bit like a legal contract, like the party of the first part and the party of the second part. But, this idea of what's subjective and what's objective is really important in Zen. Really, really important. We live in a culture that says the highest truth is fact. That's the highest knowledge, fact. And yet, the interesting thing is that when we get the facts, they don't always move us. They don't change us, So maybe facts are important, but they're not the highest knowledge. There's a different kind of knowledge. A young man came today who has been training in the Vipassana tradition. And, I am quite in admiration of Vipassana in the United States because I think Vipassana has blossomed in America. And I'm thrilled by that. I really think Vipassana is in many ways the kind of meditation practice that the Buddha himself taught, that Shakyamuni taught. And, it's very simple and very direct. You're observing your sensations from moment to moment. That's pretty much all there is to Vipassana, only you do it with greater and greater mental control and greater precision, And so, Vipassana is all about observing dispassionately what is going on with your sensations from moment to moment. So, if you're meditating in Vipassana, at first you watch the breath until you can stabilize your mind, and then you begin to note your physical sensations. And this is actually a very hard work and takes a lot of control. So, as you're sitting on your cushion, you might hear the fan. And then you might notice that it feels a little warm in here, or you might feel a little wind on your cheek. And you notice your cheek is hot. Then you feel the pressure of your instep on your thigh, because maybe it's been there for a while and it's starting to put pressure. And maybe your instep is feeling a little pain at this point. Then you notice that you're hungry. Then you notice that you're swallowing a lot. And then you hear the fan. And what you're supposed to do is just keep noting what you are aware of from moment to moment. And in some schools of Vipassana, people just note. So you hear the fan. You feel your leg, you feel your thigh, you note that you're swallowing, You just keep pointing your mind to what is happening without any kind of selection principle. And believe it or not, eventually you get incredibly detailed at this. You can get incredibly detailed. So, basically you might think, when you put a comb and run it through your hair, it's a simple act. But if you've been trained in Vipassana, there are 100 moments involved in that act. You know, when you go in to see the teacher, like in Dokusan, you know, the teacher will say, well, tell me about combing your hair. You say, well, I put the comb in and pull it back. You know, it's like, well, back to your hair, you know. So you have to really, really focus on every moment of awareness, you know. And in theory, in Vipassana, there's like thousands of moments of awareness in every minute, you know. So there's nobody who is that acute on earth, but they get, Vipassana practitioners can get very, very acute in observing their sensations in a dispassionate way from moment to moment. I have really a great respect for Vipassana. And I think that it is definitely a route to awakening, to enlightenment. Many years ago, when Mr. Goenka from India, the great Vipassana teacher, came to Rutgers, he gave a talk. And I went to the talk. In fact, believe it or not, our group invited him here. I gave him a talk, and he gave a talk, and it was a wonderful talk. And I listened very closely to hear what he said about enlightened mind. And in some ways, what he said was a little bit indirect, you know, so not everybody would appreciate it, I think. But what he said, anybody who understands the awakening experience would understand that he has had that experience. It was like a very, very clear, pure statement. So, you know, I was really impressed with his talk. I thought, well, that's what we call enlightenment, too. And then I went to his trailer after the event, because he was traveling all over the United States in the trailer, and I introduced myself, and I said, you know, I teach Zen, and he said, oh, you should practice Vipassana. I said, well, you know, Zen, we also have the same idea of enlightenment. He said, oh, Vipassana, Vipassana, you know. Then they moved me along. So that was my encounter with Mr. Goenka. So, you know, I understand. Everybody has their own, you know, thing. But you know, I think Vipassana has been hugely successful in America, and it really does help people. People become calmer. They become more mentally focused. Mr. Goenka has very clearly achieved enlightenment, you know. But, you know, Vipassana isn't everything. You know, I think one of the reasons Vipassana is so popular in the United States is that it sounds like science, right? It sounds like objectivity. See, it sounds like objectivity. So, you know, observing from moment to moment with an impersonal mind is the method of Vipassana. And you know what? It's, in many ways, it's the method of science, right? So I think Americans have really taken to Vipassana because it resonates with what we think of as a truth, objectivity, right? So you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath until your mind becomes stable, and then you note your sensations, and it's actually objective. You know, it's like objective. First this, then this, then this, then this. And there's two schools of Vipassana. Some people just note, and some people say a word. So when you're breathing, some teachers say, label it. So when you note your breath, you say breath. When you note your pain, you say pain. When you note your knee, you say knee. And some people say don't use labels, just note. So, you know, Vipassana is very, very like science in its orientation. And I think that's why it is so wildly popular here in the United States. And I'm happy that it is so popular. However, you know, it's not the only path to walk. You know, Zen has a different attitude, you know. So, you know, Zen is not about separating yourself from the object of consciousness. You know, it's not about actually observing dispassionately, believe it or not. You know, so if you're having a sensation in your leg and you become aware of the sensation, becoming aware of the sensation and labeling it sensation is a distancing device. It's distancing. You know, so if you're breathing and you're following the breath and you become aware of your breath and you say breathing, you know, note to self, breathing. You are distancing yourself from the breath. So, you know, a Vipassana has a theory of attentiveness or attention. And it's based upon the idea of being separate from the object of observation. And this is an ancient Buddhist view. This was the ancient Theravada teachers believed this was how it should go, you know. So basically, we observe with a neutral mind, objectively, what is happening from moment to moment. And this is the method that, actually not the method the Buddha taught, but it's the method that early Buddhists developed. And it's been passed on through Vipassana. Now, you know, Zen comes out of a different tradition. Different tradition. You know, Zen comes out of something called the Mahayana, the Great Way. You know, I mean, you know, the people in the Mahayana called themselves the Great Way. Where does that leave everybody else? I realize that that name is a little bit of a clever PR tactic. So, you know, people who practice old Buddhism were called Theravada. That's a path of the elders. And the Mahayana people call themselves the Great Way, and they sometimes call Theravada the Little Way, which is not very fair, and it hurts people's feelings, you know, which we shouldn't do. So I don't think we should call them Theravada. I mean, Hinayana. I think we should call them Path of the Elders, Path of the Elders. But, you know, the Mahayana people all trained in Theravada traditions long ago, and they began to have questions about it because, you know, they said, okay, so basically you say there's no self. I mean, the Theravada view is like this. The Theravada view is you have a lot of a subjectivity you have to get rid of. You need to be objective. And eventually, if you become totally objective, you will liberate yourself and you will have nibbana, they say. N-I-B-B-A-N-A, Nibbana, which is the Pali. Nirvana is the Sanskrit, which was a later Indian language. So the idea is, you know, basically free yourself from these defilements, from these confusions, by being a totally objective, and at the end, you will be liberated. You, Bill, or you, Bob, or you, Susan, will be liberated. And, you know, the early Mahayana teachers came along and said, well, wait a minute, I'm confused about something. I thought you said there was no self. Yes, we did. We said there's no such thing as a self. Well, so how can Bob be liberated? See the question? How can Susan get liberated if there is no self? Who, if Susan doesn't exist and Bob doesn't exist, then who the heck is getting enlightened? Who the heck is getting liberated? See, so Mahayana and Theravada people all practiced in the same monasteries, believe it or not. There wasn't like the Protestants and the Catholics. They didn't have a war that went on for 50 years. That didn't happen. They disagreed, but they, you know, they ate at the same table, they were friends, and so on. But Mahayana people said, there's a problem with that. You know, this idea that there's an individual salvation, we don't think that's true because there's no essential self. So this started like a kind of a peaceful revolution in Buddhism. And Zen is at the other end of this very peaceful revolution. But, you know, people began to say, well, who is getting liberated? If Bob doesn't exist and Susan doesn't yet exist, then who the heck is, after all this work, is getting to be in Nirvana? This started a different approach in the Mahayana. See, the Mahayana said, maybe this idea of objectivity is not really so great. Not really so great. Because objectivity is not any more real than subjectivity. See, they're both very arbitrary. Both very arbitrary. So, you know, Mahayana does is put a lot of attention on just being with things as they are before they're objective and they're subjective, you know, you could say. Another way to put it is that Mahayana believes in not in detaching yourself, but becoming one with. See? Not pulling back, but becoming one with. See, this is a very different orientation. So instead of retreating and trying to be objective, we become one with the object of our attention. Yeah. So, different method. You know, when we watch the breath, that stage one is like Vipassana style watching of the breath. So you're watching the breath, you're noting breath. And that's very hard, right? When you're watching the breath, you think about the new movie you saw. If you're in love, you think about the person you love. If you're hungry, you think about the next meal. You're trying to focus on the darn breath, you know? And it's very hard. It's very elusive. So just being able to focus the mind like a flashlight on the breath is very important, you know, very, very crucial skill and difficult. It takes months of practice to be able to do that for like 5 minutes. You know, it's not the case that the people generally come in, sit down on the cushion, and they're focused on the breath for half an hour. That would be amazing. If you try to do that, you might actually burst into sweat about 15 minutes in. You know, and at the end, you might actually be tired, because that's hard to sustain that level of focus concentration. More likely, a good sit is that you sit down, you're watching the breath, your mind wanders, you pull it back, your mind wanders, you pull it back, your mind wanders, you pull it back, and then for a while, for an interval, maybe 5 good minutes, you know, you're really with the breath, 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 and the thoughts have receded, and they're on that margin of your consciousness, see. So stage one is noting the breath, just like Vipassana, stage one. But stage two, we say, you know, that become one with your breath. Become one with your breath. And people, at first they don't understand what that means, you know. What do you mean, become one? People say, what are you talking about? What, one with my breath? Look, the breath goes in, the breath goes out. You know, the breath goes in, the breath goes out. That's not really, that's not what we call knowledge in Zen, see. That's maybe knowledge in some traditions, but we don't think that's knowledge because you're still separate from the object of your attention. You're actually very separate. Now, it's better than just losing yourself in your thoughts, and it takes a lot of work, so I'm not putting it down. But it's not what where we really want to go in the Mahayana, see. So when we focus on the breath, we note the breath, but eventually we become one with the breath. See, there are these moments in life when, you know, you're not thinking anymore, and you're just totally one with the object of your attention. Sometimes this happens spontaneously. You know, this morning I was driving here on this incredibly gorgeous summer day, and I was coming through Piscataway, and there's this old farm that they condemned and that they're making into a park someday. And it was to my left as I'm driving down the road, and there was a blanket of mist over the field, and the sun was coming up, and the sky at that moment was like crystal clear, like a baby blue. So, you know, I looked, and you know, I can describe it to you now, but I didn't think about it that way when I saw it, you know? It just took me out of myself. You know, it just took me out of myself. For a minute, I became one with that whole scene. Then I started thinking about it. I said, oh, isn't that beautiful? Isn't that lovely? You know, maybe I can talk about that at the Taisho today. So I blew it, you know, in a way. You know, everybody does that. We can explore why that happens in some other koan. But thinking is part of being a human too, so you can't infinitely suppress that, you know. But we do have these moments where we become one with the object of our attention, and usually it feels liberating. It feels like you're alive, you know. So we Zen people put a lot of faith in that experience. See, from the Zen standpoint, it's all one life. It's all one life. And we cut it into pieces. You know, we cut it into pieces. And when we do that, you know, we do that to make ourselves safe, to make ourselves happy. We think, and sometimes it's necessary. You know, I'm glad somebody cut bodies into pieces. My old friend John Sunston was a professor of anatomy, and he, you know, I'm glad they're doing it. But that's not the only way to know. You know, sometimes we know this other way. It's like, I think modern people have overdeveloped brains. It's like part of our brain is like super well developed. It's the part that cuts things into pieces. It's the part that separates and observes. It is objective. And I think the other part of our brain, the part that becomes one with, and I almost said subjective, but it's not subjective because the sense of self disappears. That other part of the brain is not well developed. It's not well developed. And so I think that's one of the reasons people, you know, when they turn away from facts, they can believe the most crazy things. It's like we have very educated fact minds and very ignorant becoming one with minds, you know. And Zen is about educating that other mind, that mind which is the mind of wholeness or the mind of connectedness. It acts from, it's all one life. See? So you know, people, you know, when they're told to watch the breath, they do what they've been trained to do all their lives. You know, they become objective observers of their breath. And the teacher says, you know, teacher says, well, you know, that's good. I'm glad. You're doing a good job. But please, become one with your breath. See, and that's hard for us because we don't know how to do it. We do it spontaneously. You know, you walk out. Yeah, last night, there was a full, I think it was a full moon. Maybe it's not, but it's so close. And the sky was cloudless. There weren't a lot of people last night here, but we walked out and it was like the perfect night. Not too hot. The sky was cloudless, and there's this incredible moon hanging over in the sky. You know, for a minute, you just become the moon. You just become, this is not romantic. This is health, mental health, actually. You become the moon. See? And when that happens, you know, you're in a different place cognitively and emotionally. You know, that when you're in that state, you feel liberated and you feel alive and you also feel trust. Trust. See, that's why this poem, which we recite called Trust in Mind, gets into this whole thing about the object's mind, the subject. You know, it could be a little better, you know, could be improved. But this is what Tsang-tsan is getting at. This is what Tsang-tsan is getting at, that this is so important, you know. But there's another way of experiencing the world. And in China, people were confused about this too. You know, Confucianists were big scholars. They liked objective truth. They liked objective truth. They believed there's a place for everything and a place and everything in its place. That was Confucianism. Confucianism had many good aspects. But it had a sort of an objectivity mind, a little too much. And, you know, Lao Tzu and Zen, you know, they say, wait, that's not everything, please. You know, there's this other mode of being, which is really more important. You know, so Confucian scholars, too, like had overdeveloped discriminating minds, overdeveloped objectifying minds, and underdeveloped oneness minds. Yeah. So I can see why Vipassana has become so popular, because it sounds like objectivity. It takes you to the right place, but the method is very different from our method. Our method is to become one with, see. So, you know, when you're watching the breath, stage one is, you know, basically noting the breath, just as you would in a Vipassana retreat. But stage two is becoming one with. And when you become one with, it's a totally different experience. It's a different world. And that's where we have these crazy insights, you know. If you become one with your breath, you know, you might find, for example, that your mind just becomes totally blank. Totally. Right? How did that happen? See, and you know, people often, they don't even, this happens to them, like multiple times, but they just ignore it, because what's that all about? Back to watching the breath. You know, actually this happened to me. You know, I was working on the breath koan, and I'd go in to see the Roshi, and I would say, Genki Roshi, you know, the breath is going in, the breath is going out. And he'd go, oh, nice, that's the same answer you gave me last time. Ding. And then out, you know, and I kept giving him this answer. And meanwhile, I would have these experiences where my mind would become blank, but I just thought, oh, that's getting in the way. Back to the koan. You know, I didn't have a well-developed oneness mind. In fact, you know, people can even be cynical about this. They don't necessarily trust this, right? Because they're afraid that it's just subjectivity, see. Now, you know, subjectivity is not what we're up to, actually. This is not subjectivity. It's deeper. It's neither subjective nor objective. You know, people get into a lot of trouble sometimes by trusting their subjectivity. You know, I was reading just the other day about this prophet out in Utah who had a vision, and he is living out in the desert, and he's taken all these wives, and this is his vision, right? Well, you know, he needs to keep doing, he hasn't done any zazen, I would say. He has a naive oneness mind, right? Naive. If he had done some zazen, I don't think he'd wind up where he is, frankly. You know, so if you watch the breath, and you note the breath, if you become one with the breath, it opens this transformative experience. You begin to experience the world in a different way. And because we come from, you know, there were great Buddhist people who understood this right from the start, you know. So somebody like Shariputra, you know, Shariputra had been practicing meditation in India for years and years. He was an advanced master, but he couldn't achieve enlightenment. He couldn't wake up. And one of the Buddha's students told him about the Buddha's teaching, and Shariputra had Daikensho right there before he even met the Buddha. He later became the Buddha's foremost disciple. But just hearing, he grasped fully what this was about. You know, we're in a different civilization. And our minds are much, you know, if you had asked Shariputra to explain gravity, I'm sure he couldn't have done it. You know, and so, you know, we have a much better discriminating mind maybe than Shariputra. Not necessarily, but it's possible. He was pretty smart. But, you know, he beats us hands down when it comes to oneness mind. Right? There's a deep, well-developed intuitive grasp, right? Pre-subjective, pre-objective. You know. You know, when we are able to enter that blank place we call, that in Sanskrit it's called shunyata, emptiness. In Zen we call it mu, right? Or u, Chinese u, Japanese mu. When, you know, you sit there and you call mu, 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 mu. You know, eventually you can get to that blank place with great regularity, see? And that's a real achievement. That can take several years to accomplish. So if you aren't there yet, don't get discouraged. It takes most people many years to just be able to come up to that blankness and stay there. But that's still discriminating knowing, interestingly enough. You're still separate from the object of your attention. What has to happen, just as you became one with your breath, you have to become one with mu. See? And that is difficult for us because we're objectifiers, right? You know, in Zen we have this crazy tradition where at sesshins people actually have to come into the Dokusan room and open their mouths and call mu out loud. And the first time you are asked to do this is the most humiliating thing in the world because we're so self-conscious, right? And then, you know, people think, okay, I can go along with this. You know, you just want me to open my mouth and be spontaneous, you know? You just want me to be subjective about it. So people come in and they moo, 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 you know, or they scream moo at the top of their lungs, or they do other crazy things that I won't relate to you. But, you know, all of this is just subjectivity. All of this is just subjectivity. You know, the teacher is looking for a deeper encounter. You need to merge yourself with that blankness. when you open your mouth, what has to come out is that that blankness has to speak through your mouth. And you can say, well, that's the craziest darn thing I've ever heard, but it's not. It's just your naive modern mind talking. That just as people can encounter the breath deeply, deeply in a transformative way, we all breathe in and we breathe out. We do it every time. It doesn't make people enlightened because of the way they experience the world. We know the O2 goes in, the CO2 goes out. We all know that. So what's to study about the breath? But in the discriminating mind, there's not much that can be achieved. But with the big mind, the Buddha mind, the unity mind, you will be changed by your knowledge, changed by what you know. And when you sit with a mu, it's the same story. You can watch the blankness. You can get to the mouth of the cave, and that's a very big achievement. And it takes years, but that is only half the journey. The other half is becoming one with, that same alternate consciousness, which is so important. That consciousness is different from your objectivity mind. So, what's wrong with us, really, is that we're so one-sided in our development. And, and scientists, they're really good people. They try so hard to change people's minds, but they're in a kind of pickle because, they've been telling people for 100 years subjectivity is crap, basically, and only objectivity is true. And now they're throwing objectivity at people, and people aren't being changed by it. But, this is exactly what they created, basically, So do you know this expression, hoist on your own petard? I never heard that. It's like you get hoisted on your own rope or something like that, on your own fishing hook or something like that, I never heard that expression, but it fits here, hoist on their own petard, whatever a petard is. They set our civilization up for this by belittling other forms of knowledge besides objectivity. And objectivity is real and valid, but it's only one kind of knowing. And so people get tons of information about global warming, and it doesn't change them. Because we don't know how to know in a way that will transform us. And Zen is all about knowing in a way that is deeply transformative because it restores our lost connectedness with things. Imagine if that's how we experience the natural world, with that connectedness mind. That is a very important aspect of Buddhism. Mythology, you could say. There's stories about, there's a wonderful story. I'll wrap it up, but it's about a bull who knew he was going to go to be slaughtered, and he actually is terrified that he knows, he figures it out. He's a smart bull. He realizes he's being led to slaughter, and he breaks free. And he runs up. This is a Buddhist story that millions of kids have grown up with in the Buddhist world. He runs up to the Buddha and says, please help me. So the Buddha says to the butcher, look, if I can gather the money to buy the bull, will you spare the bull's life? And the butcher says, yeah. Well, at first the Buddha just says, would you spare the bull's life? And the guy says, no, I can't do that. I've invested in that bull. And the Buddha said, well, if I get you the money, will you let the bull go? And the guy says, yes. The butcher and the bull are reborn in a higher form as beings who are more ready to wake up. They're both transformed by the experience. And, the Buddha's way of knowing is a different way of knowing from the butcher. It's a mythology, I know, but it's making a point about how we encounter. The Buddha encountered the bull as part of himself. The butcher encountered the bull as, $150 when it's off the hoof and in the meat rack. So these are fundamentally different ways of knowing, and Buddhism is all about helping people rediscover the world with this deeper mind. Dijon asked Feon, "Where are you going?" Feon said, "I'm going on a pilgrimage." Dijon said, "What is the purpose of the pilgrimage?" Now, if he were in objectivity mind, he'd say, "Well, it's 25 miles north of here, and if I go, I am actually enacting my commitment to the future, blah, blah, blah." But he says, "You know, I don't know. I don't live in that discriminating mind. I live in the unity mind, not knowing. And doesn't form concepts, becomes one with." And Dijon says, "Ah, that's great. Not knowing is closest. Not knowing is closest."